In his new book, Make Change, How to Fight Injustice, Dismantle Systemic Oppression, and Own Our Future, internationally noted activist organizer Sean King says that his life changed on July 2014 when a friend sent him the video of the death of Eric Garner during his arrest at the hands of officers of the New York Police Department. King says in Make Change, "The case and the injustice of the murder of Eric Garner consumed me from that day forward. I took it personally, as if this happened to a man I had called my own friend." King's activism using social media platforms would revolutionize social justice organizing and would catapult him back into the fight against police brutality and mass incarceration, making him a leading voice on the issues. Now, crowdsourced activism is a norm in our society, with broad-based, leaderless protests occurring worldwide on topics ranging from climate change to food access and clean water. However, individuals still struggle finding how they can begin to participate in causes for change that matter to them personally. Through historical studies, raw, vulnerable personal stories, and retelling of his participation in some of the most seminal civil rights actions of this generation, Sean King's Make Change, How to Fight Injustice, Dismantle Systemic Oppression, and Own Our Future offers a primer on how people can identify meaningful social issues, organize their energy, and participate in life-changing social and personal work. Organizer, activist Sean King, in conversation today on The Keenest Observers. Sean King was recently named by Time Magazine as one of the most influential people on the internet. He covers civil rights issues for The Intercept and is a writer in residence at the Fair Punishment Project at Harvard Law School. Previously, King served as a pastor, teacher, and motivational speaker in Atlanta's juvenile justice system. In 2019, King launched the media platform The North Star, as well as the popular news podcast The Breakdown. He lives in Brooklyn with his family. Sean King, thanks, and welcome to The Keenest Observers.
Yeah, glad to be here. And I do just want to say that I was on that Time magazine list as one of the most influential people on the internet, but Donald Trump was on that list. It's kind of an honor and not necessarily. It's just kind of just a statement of fact. But yeah, when I first found out I was on that list, I felt like super excited. Then I saw the list and I was like, oh, Trump's on here too.
Hey, you know, yeah. The company is an interesting group nowadays in terms of doing good work or, you know, being around people who push your work as well.
Absolutely.
Most definitely. Thanks for being here. I call Make Change a primer. What do you call it?
No, I think that's it, man. I think I would call it an answer to the question that I got more than any other question over the past 6 years. And I had a chance since the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement. I traveled to 47 states, including deep into North and South Dakota, all the way up to Alaska, deep into the heart of the South. Of course, I was in all of America's biggest cities, and I don't know that anybody traveled to as many places over this time, but everywhere I went, including before the pandemic when I would just be walking on the streets of New York, people would stop me and ask, Sean, I'm frustrated about injustice. I'm frustrated about police brutality and mass incarceration, but what do I actually do about it? And I would get 50 variations of that question, but at the root, it was all the same thing. Of people who are aware of the problem, and I think, man, that we're at a place right now where there's this heightened awareness of systemic inequality, of racism, of injustice. But even today, people continue to come to me and say, but what do I actually do about it? And for the past 6 years, I've tried to squeeze my answer into little sound bites. And I would try to give a nugget or two, but finally I just relented and said, I need to stop and think and study and write this out. And my book, in a lot of ways, is a 272-page answer to that question. How do you use your life to actually make deep systemic change? And it's a guide, It's a manifesto. It's autobiographical in parts, but I really wrote it to be a book that you would live and follow. And thankfully, I'm seeing people that have already read it from cover to cover and are starting to put it to good use. And that's why I wrote it, was for people to really use it.
Yeah, I think that that's a beautiful way to describe the work. And as someone who did read it cover to cover, what I found is it not only had an application to how to insert into movements, but it also, and probably as important, grounded, you know, a way for people to be able to organize their own lives in a way to find some real identity and purpose. Was that your intention as well?
It all is connected, because everybody who reads, and I've had several people who read it also reached out to me and said the same thing, that they saw this as a way of just even viewing how they live life differently, about being clear on where your life is, not only where your life is taking you, but about where you take your life. What is the cause that you're devoted to? And I'm on a online book tour, and I say something to every event. I do two events every single day. Here's how I know that you've actually chosen a cause. It's not if I ask you, because if I ask a person, they'll tell me what their cause is. I know what your cause is if I ask your family and they know, if I ask your friends and they know. When you've chosen a cause, everybody around you will be clear about that. Like, you could ask anybody in my ecosystem, what cause is Sean devoted to? And they're going to be able to tell you police brutality and mass incarceration. I'm on it every day. And a lot of people, they think they've chosen a cause, but if the people around you don't know that, you probably haven't made the choice the way you think you have.
And we're going to get into to literally the structure of the book in the segments to follow. And I hope you give me some grace, because I had to compress, you know, your beautiful structure, because I think it's such a way of looking at how to go step by step and identify what's personal and move it to action. I'm talking to Sean King. His new book, Make Change, dropped actually last week. We'll be back. Sean, I want to get into the structure of the book and how you help people move through identifying what their purpose is in terms of connecting with social change actions. And if you will, again, give me some grace, because I know the book is divided into three parts. But what I found so beautiful is that you give four really cogent steps. You say, to make a change, you must first make a choice. Then you must be an energized person, but you also have to be an organized person. And then you have to know how to make or engage with spaces that have sophisticated plans. And then you have to deal with your mistakes and rebound from your failures and stay sane. Okay. Before we even touch that, though.
That sounds like a good book, man.
Yeah. I'm you like that? You like that book?
I'm just listening. I'm like, man, that sounds like a good book. And, you know, it's beautiful to hear somebody, you know, recount it to you, because you don't write it like that. You write each chapter was a deep dive, and I tried to weave the threads together. But it's good to be able to kind of hear somebody look at it from 30,000 feet above and get some of those points.
Yeah, and I think that that's, again, I think when folks are trying and people are trying and authors are trying and just people are trying to communicate, the ability to be able to have those kinds of steps be clear and understandable is necessary. It's beyond necessary.
Well, you know, what I find is it's heartbreaking in a way, is that in spite of massive awareness and sometimes a historic level of energy given to the issues of injustice, even if we just looked at this year, the energy behind the protest around Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd, just a historic level of energy, outrage, frustration. But what's heartbreaking to me is that there is often this high level of energy that doesn't necessarily result in change. And I've gone down that path of pouring my heart and soul into building awareness and building energy, but I've learned something that's disturbing, and it's a particular, I don't want to say addiction, but like trend in American life, is that this country is fully willing to be aware of our worst problems and yet do nothing about it. And when we put all of our effort into building awareness and energy, but don't actually have the organized systems and structures, don't actually have the plans that are as sophisticated and robust as the problem, what happens is we put all of this energy into our fight for change, and at the end, we see very little of it. And I think that some of why people are so frustrated in 2020 is these are protests we've already had. We've already said we have to confront these problems. Yesterday was the sixth anniversary of the death of Michael Brown. I had a chance to talk with his father. These protests that we're having in 2020 are the same as the protests we had in 2014, 2015, and so on. It's not to say that our protests are wrong. They're not. We're right to protest. We're right to demonstrate. But I need readers and I need your audience to understand that people in power in this country are fully willing to watch our protest and not change an inch, not budge a little bit. And what they often try to substitute is awareness for action. They say, we see you. We understand you. We are aware of this problem, and you have our thoughts and prayers, and the problem remains. And awareness is a poor substitute for action and change. But often that's all we get in this country, is a whole lot of awareness of our worst problems. And the book is a guide to take us to the steps beyond awareness. We're all aware. Now what?
Right. You talk about how the status quo, as you call it, manifests itself over and over and over again, and how that erodes on the spirit of folk, not only who choose to engage and interrupt the status quo, but even folks who don't know that they're a part of the cycle. And so the bridge to awareness to action is literally what you kind of, in my opinion, was what I glean, you're trying to literally build.
I'm trying, because I think that even our best, I'm even hesitant to say this because it seems like an insult to people who have literally been giving their lives in marches and demonstrations. And I say that literally because people have been killed at protests just this summer. Like, we will look back on this moment as a moment where there were literal martyrs killed at protests and demonstrations where thousands of people have been injured. The awareness that these protests creates, that awareness is essential. You don't get change without the awareness. But awareness is probably step one in a 10-step process for how change happens. And so what we see, and Minnesota is a great example, that their state legislature this summer had nearly 30 different bills and policies being proposed that they would change around the issue of criminal justice. and they ended up ending their legislative session without passing a single bill. And this is the ground zero of this moment that we're in. And there was this massive awareness, and there's been some change in Minneapolis, but when the state had an opportunity to actually make change, it didn't do it. And I see that happening already in cities and counties and states all over the country from leaders who said, listen, Black lives do matter. But then when you say, well, show me the policy, show me the budget. And when we talk about defunding the police, I actually think people can debate whether or not that's the right phrase, but I think it's the smartest evolution of this movement that I've ever seen, because defunding the police is people saying, thank you for your body cameras. Thank you for painting this mural on the ground. Now let me look at the budget. And I was a pastor for many years, and there's a scripture that says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. What it means is where your money is, that's where your heart is. And leaders across the country, activists and organizers are saying, we want to look at the budget. Mm-hmm. Show us the budget and show us how Black lives actually matter beyond how you police them, beyond how you arrest them. Show us your priorities in your line items. And that's a significant evolution from where we were just a few years ago.
Right. I think that's an interesting connection and segue to how you set the book up. You talk about a historical theory that you learned in graduate school that you termed the dip, that talks about the evolution of human beings and society. And our presumption that it's a steady climb of evolution and development, and what you find is something different. And the reason why I want to bring that up is because it's great contextualization, but also it connects to what you just said in terms of those that have gone before. And I'm a solid Gen Xer. So it's interesting to see in this time, you know, in the crossroads of movements, you know, pre-internet, I'm like right when the internet started, right?
Yeah.
There were folks that were doing this work in the traditional ways and traditional institutions, and those spaces dissipated in terms of like the youth organizing and the youth participation that are now on the front line that are really moving things forward. I want to ask you kind of a two-part question that connects to the dip, but you are a pioneer of using the internet as a way to bridge that time and space. Why do you think there's such a gap, and how does that connect to the dip?
You know, I almost called the book The Dip, and that theory that I share comes from this 19th century historian, Leopold von Ranke, which really changed the way I see where we are right now. And it's changed the way I've seen even these past few years. What von Ranke did was he laid out all of human history in one of the first real comprehensive timelines. And what he thought he was going to find was kind of history's version of Darwinism, where if Darwin believed human beings are steadily evolving biologically, what von Ranke expected to find was that human beings would be steadily evolving historically, getting better and better and better. But what he found instead was a roller coaster of human beings that would actually be, he found entire periods of humanity where humans were peaceful, where there was no war, where there was no famine. It doesn't mean that it was perfection, but he found periods of human history where there was great harmony, and then human beings would collapse in genocide and war and mass murder and claw their way out, up and down, up and down. It's not Darwinism at all. It's a roller coaster of peaks and valleys. And that contradicts our natural human tendency to think that humanity is just getting better. And I illustrate in the book something that is really important. Every time there is this painful moment that reminds us of a different era, people will say something like, what is this, the 50s? Or what is this, the 60s? What they mean is, I thought we had gotten past this. I thought we were better than this. And what von Ranke's theory of history says is that that's not how history works. The 70s aren't better than the 60s. The 2000s aren't better than the 80s. We're up and down in peaks and valleys. And I think right now, I don't know that anybody would dispute it, we're in a valley, not just because of the coronavirus, but yes, because of it, because of mass incarceration, because 50 million people don't have health insurance in this country. Hate crimes are at a modern high. And so here we are in this moment of despair, but there's something about it that scares me, and it's how I try to use social media. These dips in human history, sometimes they can last for a literal season, a summer, a spring, a fall. Sometimes they can last for a few years if you think of the Holocaust. But in other dips in human history, like the transatlantic slave trade, dips can last for hundreds of years. And getting out of the dips are always, it's always way more difficult than how easy you got into it. And the scary part is most deep dips in human history took civil wars to get out of. And I'm not saying that that's where we're heading. If it doesn't take a civil war, it takes something like the civil rights movement. It takes a massive amount of organizing and effort and sacrifice and intention. And I don't know that we've organized ourselves enough to get out of the place that we found ourselves in.
And so you say then it's up to an individual on your first step to look inside and decide if they want to make a change and what that is going to be and what that choice is going to be. And you do that in the greatest storytelling traditions, by telling your own story and how you had to walk your walk and make that choice. Briefly, can you recount like how that went and how that led you to make the understanding that thing that had to be a very personal choice?
Well, you know, in chapter two of the book, if any chapter was autobiographical, it would be chapter two of the book where I tell my human story of what I dealt with and encountered. And I pepper the book with other stories from my life. But chapters 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are me trying to lead people through their story and asking you hard questions about decisions that you need to make on where you're going to take your life. But in chapter 2, I go ahead and share one of the hardest, most difficult moments of my life. I grew up in rural Kentucky, and in 1995, after dealing with 2 years of nonstop bigotry and racism at my high school there in Versailles, Kentucky, in March of 1995, I was beaten so badly by a group of racist white students there at the high school that I missed the rest of my sophomore year and all of my junior year of high school. I had 3 spinal surgeries, fractures in my face and ribs. I was diagnosed with PTSD. I had to go through months of brutal physical therapy. And at the end of all of that, when I finally recovered, it changed me, man. And not all in a good way. It took some things out of me. I no longer had the energy and youthfulness that I had before the assault. Like, I lost a level of innocence from it as well. But when I emerged from that, I was someone who cared deeply about injustice. I was somebody who cared deeply about people who are experiencing pain, physical pain, abuse, people who've been abandoned by the system. And it sent my life down a very different path. And I had to make a decision, and it's a decision that I hope that it doesn't take all that I went through for people to make their own decision. But I had to make a decision. What am I going to do with what happened to me? How am I going to live my life in light of what I had to endure and overcome? And eventually that led me to this modern movement. It was in 2014 when Eric Garner was killed. And I had fought against police brutality many times before, but I finally said, I'm going to throw my whole life into this. And I didn't have all the answers. I literally quit my job, not even knowing how I was going to provide for my family. Many people did that. And decided somehow I'm going to use the rest of my life to reducing the footprint and impact of police brutality and mass incarceration. Now, your listeners, they don't have to make that decision. But if you're going to impact the world and make change, you have to make some decision.
We're going to pick up. I'm sorry to interrupt. We're going to pick up there right after this break. We're talking to Sean King. His new book, Make Change, is out. Stay tuned. Previous segment, I had to interrupt you, and you were, I believe, about to say you hope that folk didn't have to go through what you had to go through to identify their purpose.
Robert, I was imagining, what if when you came back, I was just still talking? I just never stopped.
Never stopped.
You thought you interrupted me, but I just kept on going.
Did he know? Did he know we were gone?
Like what? There was a break? You know, man, I've learned something. It sounds so simple, man, but until you decide that you're going to throw your life into a cause, you float around in a space where you sincerely, earnestly care about the world. You do. I'm not insulting your listeners. You care. The world bothers you. It disturbs you. But until you decide to really throw your all into something, you just float around in a space where you're irritated. You might retweet some things. You might click the angry face emoji on Facebook. But until you actually say, you know what? I'm going to spend the rest of my life fighting back against climate change. You know what? I'm going to fight for girls and women and their safety and protection in society. That's my cause. My wife, her cause is childhood literacy. And because she chose it, she has now done so many things in that space. And it wasn't really until I chose the cause that doors began opening up to me. And until you choose it, you kind of stay stuck in a space where you're just irritated that you don't really see the change that you want. Over the past 6 years of this movement, because I made a decision, man, there have been a lot of fights where we failed, but we've also had fights and battles for change where we succeeded. Just 2 months ago, we helped pass Breonna's Law, which banned no-knock warrants in Louisville. Now, Breonna Taylor, who was killed when police entered her home with a no-knock warrant, shouldn't have had to die for such a law to pass. But nobody in Louisville will ever die that way again. And these are the policy victories and the moments where we actually make real change. But you have to make a decision that you're going to plug in and throw your life into it. And until you do that, you'll just be frustrated. And once you make the decision, though, you kind of see the world through new lenses.
Mm-hmm. Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive and go do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive.
That's right.
So you offer that quote by theologian Howard Thurman, who you said, whose book you said Dr. King carried with him every day on the Montgomery bus boycott.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I
think you loved Howard Thurman, man. And even Howard Thurman was his chaplain at Boston University when he went up there for his PhD. Howard Thurman graduated Morehouse about 25 years before Dr. King. But Howard Thurman, in a lot of ways, was kind of the theologian of the movement. And Dr. King and others learned a lot about the strategy of peaceful, nonviolent resistance and others. They learned that from Howard Thurman, who had studied it in India and other places. And that book, Jesus and the Disinherited, Dr. King was just deeply motivated by that. And went back and visited often. And King had sophisticated plans that met the moment. And my fear is that we often duplicate some of the highlights of what Dr. King did with our marches and demonstrations. But we also have to get deep into the things that civil rights leaders strategized with behind closed doors before the March on Washington, when there were no cameras, no films being made. They thought through robust strategies to make change, and it led to a lot of groundbreaking change.
Yeah, I want to try to link a few things together in that vein. You go in on that first section to link folks and kind of mitigate folks's reasons for not moving, right? You know, don't lend yourself to excuses. Jump in and learn by doing, moving yourselves through the mundane, what may be the mundane acts and that organizations need to move forward, bringing your gifts to bear in those spaces. But then you do talk about what is needed in organizational spaces once you've shown up. How have you found, when you have such a broad base of folk in the information age, that people show up once they've decided?
Well, there's a lot that people bring to the table, and I think that's probably the most clumsy part of trying to make change, is going from being a frustrated person at home who is starting to read the books and study the issues, and people are doing that all over the country right now. How do you go from that to being a part of a local or national organization as a volunteer, as a participant, as a staffer? And in some ways, it's up to those of us that run organizations to make that on-ramp smoother for people to be able to go from their living rooms and kitchens and workplaces to becoming volunteers and staffers and organizers. Because people come to the table sometimes having no idea what to do. And what happens is, it's no different than if you get, I remember, this is not in the book, but I got hired for a job at a taco place when I was 16 years old. And my supervisor must have been the most inept supervisor of all time. Me and my buddy Rico, who is in the book, both got hired. And they put us in the kitchen. Our mothers had never taught us how to cook. And we were literally back there by ourselves. And they would yell back there like, make a double cheese burrito with such and such. Like, nobody had even taught us how to make the burrito. And sometimes they would yell things back there that wasn't even like a burrito. It would be like an item on the menu. We had no idea how to make. We were there for like 3 days and we quit. Mm. Well, that often happens in organizing spaces. People don't naturally know what to do. And if you don't show them, what happens is they get frustrated. Sometimes they may become overbearing. They may try to step in and lead and kind of have weird, awkward moments. Sometimes people, particularly if you are white in a predominantly black space, you may say the wrong thing. And what I try to say to listeners and in the book is, you got to be willing to weather out those rough moments. If you go to a meeting and it's not as organized as you had hoped, you go to a meeting and it's awkward, or if you're starting to strategize and everything isn't as smooth as corporate America, you have to think in a lot of ways that organizations are like startups. They're brand new. They're trying to figure out these problems on the fly. And so when you begin to throw your life into a cause, you just have to have a lot of patience, man, because it can be rocky in those early days. But if you stick it out, you'll not only gain the trust of the leaders in that organization, but you'll build your own resiliency up and begin to kind of get your feet under you.
Mm-hmm. You talk about also the fact that when folk come as energized new folk into those spaces, that the energy tends to be, how you call it, reactionary, sometimes more than, you know, a developed way of moving past the response that might be connected to whatever social challenge or transgression. What's the bridge from being reactionary to then what you move to and organize people in that chapter, learning how to move within structures, plans, and response to folks' networks to make, you know, to begin the significant change plans?
Well, you know, the first stage of being a part of a movement is that energy. It's frustration. It may be desperation, but to move from kind of highly energized to deeply organized requires a real pivot. And for the most part, we are way more energized than we are organized. And the response is not to take the energy down. We need the energy up. The response is, how do we increase the quality of our organization around how we organize people, how we determine what people's skills and gifts are? You know, there are two things that I hope all organizations do and people who are volunteering for them can help. One is try to figure out what are the skills and gifts of the people there so that people can use their education, their training, their expertise in ways that really matter. It's a human resource that needs to be used, and most organizations aren't really capturing that human resource in a way that I think is important. And then secondly, we try to ask people in our organizations, who do you know that could help this cause? So when you come on as a volunteer, one of the questions we ask people is, who else do you know in your life, in your family, in your place of employment, that you, in your network in some way, that you think might be able to really bring something to the table? And all of that is just about becoming deeply organized. And it takes effort. It takes trial and error, you know, and there are growing pains anytime you do it. But if we're going to actually fight back against some of the biggest problems of our lifetime, it's going to require all of our skills, all of our resources. It's going to require our networks. It's going to require so much. And so, you know, people have to prepare to not give kind of their extra time to the cause, but you have to ask yourself, how can I provide my best skills and some of my best time and energy to this thing?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I love how you gave an example about your own realization that you are, I'm going to put it in my words, a visionary and a starter of ideas, but you realized that you needed to be able to hand off things to folk who could, like, really, you know, show them, who had mastery in establishing and moving things forward on a day-to-day basis. What's the role of that self-discovery and growth?
Before I learned that lesson, I tried to do a lot of things on my own and just failed over and over and over again. And that's natural. Some of that was I was younger and less experienced. Some of it was even ego in a sense of thinking like, oh, yeah, I can do all of this. And after trying to do so many different tasks and either being overwhelmed by the magnitude of the work or overwhelmed by the depth of it and realizing, oh, I actually don't have five of the necessary skills to even do some of this, it eventually led me to realize that it sounds so simple even hearing myself say it out loud, but that to really be effective as an organization, if there are 100 skills that a human being can have, I probably only have three or four of those, like really well-developed skills. You have to find people to compensate for those other 96 things. And on our staff now, I help run an organization called the Grassroots Law Project. And in our staff, we have so many of those skills covered of people who are, I don't just try to hire people who are like mirrors of me. The staff is full of people who are radically different than who I am.
Sean King, thanks for your work. The book is Make Change. It was out this past week. Thanks for speaking with you, and much work and love to you.
Yeah, man. Enjoyed it. Take care.
That's it for today's exchange. You can learn more about the program, listen to the program, or suggest a guest at our website, jeffexchange.org. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. The Exchange is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker. Student assistant Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is next. If you're listening to our evening reprogress, stay tuned for news from the BBC. I'm Robert Goodwin. Have a great day.